Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they got it right. Here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty does work for you. And this is Tom Nivolus, your host. And wow, we have so much to cover, as always. And we're going to stay on the theme right now of Federalist Number 10, and then the back and forth conversation relative to the Anti-Federalist Number 10. But I do have to apologize to you that this week, from last week's program, I mentioned that I was going to try and do some fill-in because there's just so much content when we start thinking about this subject matter and this particular discussion that is so pertinent to what's going on today. And the idea of what are first principles, how do they function, what's that all about? So I didn't get a chance to do any midweek type of programming for you and put that up on YouTube because life does happen. And I spent about 3 days underneath my big old 94 Suburban changing out the exhaust system on that puppy. And as a result, I just did not have the time, the capacity, or quite frankly, the energy to come back and do anything else midweek, especially on such an interesting topic as this. But what I was able to do is I mentioned to you last week, and the follow-up was something about James Madison and James Madison's teacher at Princeton. So there's a couple tidbits that I just kind of want to open this first segment with as some of the fundamental historical background that I think is very, very important to understand when we think about these founding fathers, what they did, who they were, what impacted them, what gave them the ability to think through all the different processes and come up with some of the ideas that they had. And most importantly, what were those underlying principles? So one thing that I can say, and there's not a lot about, unless you read Madison's personal writings, where he does kind of infer the depth of his spiritual background, his biblical understanding, his truths. But kind of wanted to take you through this. Did you know how tall James Madison was? I mean, he was like, was he a monster? Was he a gigantic man? Obviously, we think of him as a gigantic man for what he was able to propose relative to the new Constitution, if you will, come up with this whole formulation that pretty much established what came out of the convention of 87. Well, believe it or not, is like it was almost like a Ripley thing to me when I was doing this additional homework that I did not know about James Madison, that he was 5'4". He never weighed more than 100 pounds. So his being gargantuous, if you will, was in his mental capacity and his capacity to communicate. And he wasn't really a great communicator. He wasn't very audible, but he was powerful in his writings and his ideas and how that thought process would come together. So what I did want to reference for you, and we'll talk about him a little bit more in a few moments, is John Witherspoon. John Witherspoon was highly influential on James Madison, not only Madison, but a number of other early members of what formed this new nation. He was the president of Princeton. He came from Scotland and immediately just understood what was happening in America. He understood it because I will tell you in a few minutes. But what I wanted to do is jump back on some other interesting things about Madison, information about Madison at Princeton. He was the first graduate student of Princeton. In fact, what it was is at 18 years old, he did go to Princeton. He left the plantation where it was a family plantation He proceeded to blaze through, as the History Channel says. He proceeded to blaze through 4 years of college in 2 years. He didn't sleep, but just about 4 hours a night. And he spent the majority of his time reading law, Greek, and Roman philosophy. Okay, party students, party animals that are out there going to college. Geez, what do we have in university now but a bunch of really limp-minded individuals, partly because of the leadership at universities. I heard someone speaking from Hillsdale College, which I'll talk about in another program, but I love the way that he talked about that universities and colleges are nothing but glorified government-funded Ponzi schemes. I thought that was just outstanding comment, because that's what they are, and taking not only stealing from students, if you will, their money and their minds, but also stealing from the taxpayers under the guise of education. When here you had James Madison completed a four-year program in 2 years and sleeping only 4 hours a night, reading in the original languages, get that, law, Greek, and Roman philosophy. And he was not, or he say that he was somewhat of a natural scholar. He still then stayed at Princeton after he graduated for another year and studied Hebrew and other subjects. And it was Witherspoon who taught him, especially with in Hebrew and Greek and these other languages, because Witherspoon was very in-depth in those languages, as well as he was in history and so on. And we'll kind of talk about some of that. Some of the other things that were interesting on Madison is that he lost his bid for office in Virginia in 1777 to the State House. Because he wouldn't buy drinks. He wouldn't buy alcohol for a number of the voters on election day, which was kind of a custom, and was called, let's see, it was known as swilling the planters with bumbo. Very, very interesting. So, you know, you had your prior to election parties, so everybody got boozed up, and the more that you were able to provide, gee whiz, that's what you were able to win and buy the votes with alcohol. Wow. Kind of interesting in some respects is that that really hasn't changed, in that, you know, are you buying votes with all the promises out there instead of having a mental capacity to reach the people that you're trying to represent? And that's something else that I brought up in other programs. And was very, very interesting during the debates on the Constitution was how many Congress people should there be to properly take and represent the people. And why Sam Adams continued to argue that all politics was local was because of what we have today. There is not any way on this planet that even in our republic and even in our constitutional form of a republic, that we are properly represented in the national government by virtue of one congressperson to 1.2 million people, 1.4 million, you know, 900,000, depending on the state that you're in. But the idea that there should be one person per 30 to 50,000 people makes a whole lot more sense, because then someone is closer to the people, which makes them more likely to understand the issues that are there. So with that, as we look at federalism, which then Madison talks about in Federalist Number 10, and factions are the key component of Federalist Number 10, what we end up having is it becomes extremely critical that federalism takes hold and that we return the Senate to what it should be, as representing the states instead of the, you know, two people representing millions and millions of people. That is totally ludicrous. So let me jump over just real quick, because I think we're down to about our last 5 minutes. Is that correct? Yeah. Kathy's given me the word. So what happened with Witherspoon is that he was there in Scotland, and as a young man, he actually ended up in prison because he was observing the battle at Falkirk. The battle at Falkirk, he just didn't get out of Dodge soon enough, and because he happened to have weapons on him at the time, he was caught up in the capturing of all the people after that battle, and he got thrown in a dungeon for a while, which affected his health, and why he wasn't, it affected his vocal cords and all of that. You can imagine being locked up in a dungeon. But he really had a great calling to what he was doing in battling there for liberty in Scotland, not only personal and individual liberty, but also what that meant from a religious perspective in the Presbyterian Church. He battled, he was part of what it was known as a popular party, versus who he struggled against were the moderates or the moderatism, which even though that was the new spirit of the age with the Scottish Enlightenment, and they were what we would call the liberalism permitting inside of the church. And some of the things in doing the homework on that, it became extremely interesting, is that moderatism or moderatism really believed also that, you know what, the hierarchy of things. And we're going to have to pick some of this up as we get into the second segment, because I think it's extremely important that we understand the influence that John Witherspoon had in America, because he was so involved. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And there were a number of other things that he did on moral philosophy. And I'm obviously, I referenced that in the documentation and the references for today's program. But this was very, very interesting, is that the difference in these issues of that day, how they had even the consequences into the present of what the moderatism is versus popularism, or the popular party as it was known at that time, even from Scotland. And then what Witherspoon carried with him as he came to America, not only from that strong Puritan populist perspective that carried him immediately, almost immediately when he came to America, to Princeton as the president of Princeton, but carried him right away into the political scene. And he wasn't afraid of it, because he knew that there was no separation of church and state. Was there a separation biblically of the control of the church and state? Absolutely, he was for that understanding. But as far as ministers and Christians being involved in the political system from that populist movement perspective, you know what? He was all about that. And those are some of the things that we're going to talk about and define a little bit more, so that we have that clear understanding. And so the understanding as to how Madison was additionally influenced, that comes out in Federalist Number 10, I think, more than anywhere else when it comes to the whole discussion of the Constitution from Madison's perspective in that. And that, you know, quite frankly, it was John Witherspoon was also very much for a more centralized government. And I'll talk about that a little bit more as we move into the next segment. But I want you to take a look at SamuelAdamsReturns.net, because that's where all the archives are. And we will come back to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist Got It Right, in just a few moments after this break. So come on back, and we'll see you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, those anti-federalists. Yes, they did. They did get it right. And I'm speaking to you here today on the network that has been wonderful to me, Liberty Works Radio Network, and I'm just so delighted to be a host on this network. And as I always do, I ask you to take the time to go and look at the other programming, the program and live programming during the week, and donate. Go ahead and hit that donate button, and they need the support. They need your support as you can. So again, look at Liberty Works Radio Network and look at lwrn.net or libertyworksradionetwork.com and check it all out and see what's going on, because it is all about your liberty. And that's what John Witherspoon was all about, was liberty. He understood from the very biblical perspective that the only place that you can actually get any real liberty has to begin with a salvation. And he absolutely believed, and he wrote about that very extensively in some of his writings, as to what does that mean from that perspective of who Jesus Christ is, because Jesus is alive, he is resurrected, and that the only place that you're going to get any freedom, personal freedom, is in understanding who Jesus is and understanding what that means to you personally in having a relationship with him. So those were the fundamentals upon which Witherspoon based everything else. And then as he understood it in the context of history, in the context of what goes on in the Bible, and being able to substantiate it from then what was going on in Scotland at the time, he was very different than what was, as I mentioned in the last segment, the moderatism and the popular party or popularism. Now, the moderates, and what we're going to do is go to the introduction in his lecture on moral philosophy or moral society and what that all means. And in this introduction, I think it really talks about it in a nice way. And remember, as I said from the last segment, that Madison learned a lot and was almost very tutored by John Witherspoon. There were many of our key leaders in the period that were learned from Witherspoon when he came to Princeton. So interesting stuff here. So if we go back historically, some of the Scottish historians, what they talk about is that ecclesiastical policy, whose chief feature was absolute enforcement of the aristocratic law of patronage, whereby in practical disregard of parishioners concerned, church living were at the disposal of the patrons. And what that meant was that, and I see that in some of the very large, even Reformed churches here in America, and some of the other evangelical churches, is that, I really think that the pastors bow to patronage in so many different ways. I think that's true even of the church that Kathy and I attend more on a regular basis. So from a biblical evangelical teaching perspective, they can be spot on, but when it comes to what does it mean, especially in our constitutional republic, then I would classify them more of this Scottish philosophy of moderatism. And that means that, the real concerns for the parishioners are left up to the patronage of those who are either the power brokers politically or the money influencers. And sometimes they can be one and the same, as we well know. So we've seen that, you could go watch Pollyanna and you kind of see the same thing, where the Harringtons kind of, they told the pastor what to preach. almost, you know. So it was like moneyed interest or political interest can have great influences, and I think it affects even the philosophical position of many pastors. And that was something that was a conversation that came as a question, if you will, the last time I was on the Chris Arnzon program, Iron Sharpens Iron, and having a conversation about my last book, that not all conservatives are constitutionalists. And that is really, when it comes within the context of the churches, I think this is a very, very good definition of what that was all about. So once again, the moderateism, I always get that too. I want to put in more letters in there, you know, how you read things. So moderateism is that where it's a ecclesiastical policy whose chief feature was the absolute enforcement of aristocratic law of the patronage. So that could be like a pastor standing at the pulpit and saying, you know what, quit your whining and just pay your taxes, because according to Paul, that's what you're supposed to do, which according to our republic is not what we're supposed to do. Anyway, we're not going to go off on that one. Whereas John Witherspoon was of the popular party, or popularism, on the other hand, was the conservative and strictly orthodox party. And they combated that, and they were absolutely for the personal religion and the some relaxation of the old standards of faith and conduct, which were, you know, rising in the tide of liberalism, really being almost pietist, if you will. And it opposed strenuously the undemocratic features of the patronage law. So Witherspoon was all about that, and he actually wrote in 1753, Ecclesiastical Characteristics, and he was it was a bitter satire of these moderates. So Witherspoon was on it, you know, right from the beginning, and then he was asked to come to America, and with him coming to America, I mean, he was in ministry for 20 years in Scotland. Okay, so he was already in ministry for 20-some years before he came to America, and he did that in August of 1768. And what did he walk into? He walked into an America that was birthing. He walked into immediately seeing that there needed to be a separation from Great Britain. And he started jumping right into it. I mean, he was in there, and he participated. He was elected into local office. And in addition to that, what does he end up doing? He ends up being a delegate through that whole process at the Continental Convention that met in 74. And he represented New Jersey as one of those delegates. And he identified himself conspicuously, as it says, with what we would, what they were calling at that time a progressive party. Progressive, not in the terms of progressivism as we look at communism here in America now, but progressive from the perspective that it was the populist party that was taking a hard look at what was going on in America relative to all that was happening in England, in the parliaments, in that whole political system. He was also involved in the Presbyterian Synod of New York and Philadelphia in 1775, and he actually drew up the synod's pastoral letter, and very, very interesting, which was a big shift on a number of different things, especially later on what happened in Presbyterianism in America, and he helped direct even that whole denominational effort at the beginning, immediately after the Revolutionary War. We can go on talking about all the things he did after he got involved. He was a signer of the Declaration. He followed up with that. He was in Congress the whole time, okay? So he and John Adams were several of the people that were those mutual contemporaries that spent their whole time in Congress. He was on the Committee on Clothing for the Troops, same as Sam Adams. The Board of War, same as Sam Adams. The Committee on Secret Correspondence, same as Sam Adams. So they were peers, and what was going on during this whole time? And he was also committed to the humanitarian sort of efforts for the physical condition and of the troops and treatment of the prisoners, as well as what was going on in the medical services, and including what was going on with the grave crisis, mutiny in 1781. So not only was he concerned with everything that was happening there in Congress, but he maintained at the same time his leadership in Princeton, teaching and leading. And it just was amazing is that for the most part, he also wrote the Thanksgiving and Fast Day and Days of Prayer proclamations for Congress. And we know that Sam Adams wrote some of those, and we see that Witherspoon wrote a good many of those as well. So, I mean, he was in it, man. He was just like, or people, listeners, he was just like in it full bore. And, you know, what leadership then would all of these other young people see that participated from an educational perspective, that not only was he sound in his faith, in his capacity to lecture from the pulpit, his capacity to preach God's word, and his capacity to be that dynamically involved in what was going on in the formation and leadership of this nation. Now, one of the things that I will say is that he saw immediately that the Confederation had problems. I mean, he deplored the petty jealousies that perpetuated through inadequate authority of Congress, and especially in foreign commerce, and then also in the means by which it was to get the revenue for Congress to do what it needed to do. And so, therefore, he pleaded for a strong central government. Well, gee whiz, where do you think Madison got some of those ideas? Where do you think that Madison was able then to not only have the great mental capacity, he was observant of the actions of everything that was going on, not from... one of his mentors, John Witherspoon, one of his teachers, John Witherspoon. So I think it just makes sense that when we take and we look at the influence that one person will have upon others, that, boy, Madison, 5'4", a wet noodle, if you will, not strong of speech, had the mentorship of someone like John Witherspoon, who had a great mental capacity, had no problem whatsoever understanding the transcendence. And this is what I talk about all the time. The transcendence of all of Scripture into human society, every aspect of it. Maybe someday I'll have to do another program, but you could go to the archives and you can find where I talk about that. So here we have it, that, you know, off it goes. Witherspoon's involved. He ends up being involved in the New Jersey Convention in 1787 for the ratification of the federal constitution. He would be termed a Federalist, if you will, although he did not term himself that. But the reality being that he was someone that clearly understood what it would take to have a foundational republic in America. So as we think that through, and you go and read some of the references that I have here, come on back for the last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they absolutely got it right. But Witherspoon, And in this case, in Federalist Number 10, Madison, they got it right too. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they absolutely got it right. And this is Tom Navolas, your host here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty does work for you. And I do have to tell you that we had some technical difficulties in some of what we were doing a little bit ago. So welcome back as we try and wrap things into some continuity from what was going on in the last segment as we came back into this programming. So with that, we were talking about Madison, who was fundamentally mentored by John Witherspoon. I wanted to kind of wrap back into that a little bit, looking at where we are today and what that means from our past in respect to Witherspoon really participating in what he did on the various committees and understanding what was going on and knowing that under the Articles of Confederation there were a lot of weaknesses and problems that were happening, and that he was very, very much for taking and having a better centralized national government that could execute those types of things that need to happen when you have a number of independent republics coming together. And remember, that's what we have in the United States, is that every state is its own republic. And we just happen to be and come together within the context of our constitutional national republic. And so when we look at that, I think I left off in the last segment with the idea that we have to get federalism really working again to really understand what that means. And, you know, it was something here that was real interesting that Witherspoon did in talking about on the his speech in Congress on the financial matters actually became the basis for his essay on money that was published in 1786. And he had a lot of opponents in that, but in the long run, they actually came back to him and said, you know what, Witherspoon was correct on how we should fund and what it meant to develop a good financial system within the context of America as well. And so there are a lot of things that he talked about, things that he deplored. He deplored the petty jealousies within the states and the fact that Congress was inadequate in authority to act according to what it needed to do in preserving a union and to carry out the work that was established, those first principle works. And that's what I kind of wanted to segue with. They may have mentioned it, but I want to mention is that I heard a gentleman this past week on YouTube from Hillsdale College, who apparently was he was at the Trump administration for a period of time, and he was talking on a topic of conservatism dead, and what does it mean to bring the political process back? Oh, great. You're right. But I no wonder. Kathy just reminded me. I saw some things there, and she reminded me, even though I was seeing that I was getting some good signal talking, my microphone was down low, and it still was working. So as you can tell, hopefully that kind of quiet maybe, but now those that are on the video can see that I just popped that thing back on my ear. So good catch, Kat. That's why you're the in-house studio producer. So I appreciate that. Boy, things happening, right? So anyway, this guy from, I can't think of his name, you know, I'll have to go look it up for you and for next week, but he did a real good talk. It was hard to understand what he was saying because of the way that he talked, and I was very, very happy that the words were on the screen so I could read what he was saying. But in the end of it all, he and I do come to the same conclusion that what the heck is a conservative? And for the most fact and reality, is that conservatives don't understand the first principles of our constitutional republic. And to the extent that, as we see with Madison, who is extremely intelligent in what he did and in coming into Congress and the number of places ultimately becoming president of the United States, and with John Witherspoon, who was extremely bright and the mentor, if you will, of Madison, understood the ideas of first principles in governing, okay? And that's what it comes down to. And then it comes down to the whole thing, too, with this idea of where Witherspoon was with all these different pastors and the modern pastors that you hear that are out there and tell you from the pulpit, you know what, you know, just pay your taxes, don't complain. You know what, this is what Paul wrote in Romans, and you have to do this and all of that. You know, in my opinion, and I'm just going to keep it short here because I want to get back into Federalist 10, is the fact is that they make the plain argument that, wait a minute, if you're supposed to obey the government, that means, you know, something in our constitutional republic, you are the government. You are the ones that are responsible for your taxes via levies or the people that you elect. So, quite frankly, as smart as a lot of these pastors are, and as smart as the pastor is at the church that I attend, they don't know what they're talking about. And that goes back then to Witherspoon's argument from a populist perspective versus those moderatists or modernism, as we have talked about in the last few segments. So, let's kind of crank around here a little bit more and get right back into what we had with Federalist number 10, if you will. And we talked about factions, and that's where the real hit on that was. And one of the things that Madison was talking about, and you'll have to go back into the archives to pick up where he was talking about, there's a couple different things in factions. And there's a couple methods of controlling factions. And one is to basically destroy liberty. But if you destroy liberty, which he defines liberty is to faction what air is to fire. So if you take air out of fire, the fire goes out, very, very simply. And so if you take liberty away, then what happens? The faction goes away. But as we talked about last week, and as Madison describes in the earlier sections of Federalist Number 10, you got factions both on the right and both on the left. So you got factions on both sides of everything and everything in between. So you can't kill liberty. Then he goes on to talking about here is reason. And that as long as reason of man continues fallible, which, geez, you know, I think he got that from Witherspoon and understanding from a Presbyterian, Scottish Presbyterian, populist, reformed, reformation mind type of pastor. That means that man is fallible, meaning man is sinful, and that the only way to have true liberty is to have that true understanding of Jesus Christ and what that means in the full context of what Witherspoon would have preached from the pulpit. But anyway, Madison goes on, as long as the connection subsists between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passion will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former will be the objects to which the latter will attract. The diversity in the faculties of men from which their rights of property originate is not less an insuperable obstacle to a uniformity of interest. The protection of these faculties is the first object of government. So this is where he talks about, well, what are the objects of government? And you need to go back, and we have to understand that these guys, and when they're talking to the general public, going through what everything we just went through in this Revolutionary War, we were always battling on the ideas of what are those first principles. What does that mean? And, you know, quite frankly, we're not going to get to the end of this again this week. And that's why I said this is going to be multiple discussions just on Federalist number 10 alone. So anyway, let's talk about the latent cause of factions are thus shown in the nature of man. And again, in that sinful nature, it's all part of who we are in those latent causes. And we see them everywhere brought into different degrees of activity according to the different circumstances of civil society. A zeal for different opinions concerning religion, concerning government, and many other points, as well of speculation as of practice, an attachment to different leaders. Oh, really? The different leaders ambitiously contending for preeminence and power. Oh, geez, we don't have that going on today, do we? Nothing new under the sun there. They have, in turn, divided mankind into parties. So what we have are all these different opinions, and then we have different leaders who are ambitious, contending for preeminence and power, divide us, inflamed with mutual animosity, and rendered them much more disposed to vex and oppress each other than to cooperate for their common good. So, you know, I'm just kind of, we're going to be losing our time here shortly. But I wanted to, I think, zip into this one a little tighter, because what we have to look at is that Madison talks about all of the various interests, which are the landed interests, property owners, manufacturing interests, mercantile interests, moneyed interests, and many lesser interests that grow up of necessity in civilized nations, divide them into different classes, actuated by different sentiments and views. So the regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation, involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operation of government. So we need faction. We need all of these differences. They're always going to be a part of it because they're part of human nature. But I think one of the things that was very interesting to me just in this beginning, if you will, I still think it's the beginning of Federalist number 10, is that what Madison is talking about is that how easy it is to vex and oppress one another. And boy, do we see that going on right now. We see it with the technocrat oligarchs and so on who want power, who are playing on every emotion, who are doing all of those various things. And what he talks about is that this vexing, if you will, is so strong, is the propensity of mankind to fall into mutual animosities that where no substantial occasion presents itself, the most frivolous and fanciful distinctions have been sufficient to kindle their unfriendly passions and excite their most violent conflicts. So that's what we had kind of going on, and we continue to have going on television programs, in the media, in all of these flagrant protests in front of the White House, you know, on all different sides of these various factions. Ladies and gentlemen, what it's all about is getting down to first principles. What are the true first principles of governance? What does that mean? How do we get there? And those are some of the things that we're trying to build and talk about here on Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists got it right. Is to take all of this and render it back down. Again, from that fellow from Hillsdale would be the same thing that we talk about in my books, is that the first principles of governance are what will allow this constitutional republic to continue to operate for we the people. You're it. We're the government, okay? We are the people that make up the government. So what I'd ask you to do is go back to the archives at SamuelAdamsReturns.net Follow up from last week's program, a little bit on this week's program. We are going to do more blogging and video blogging now that we have all of the various things transferred over, as I was talking about. So I really do hope that you will come back for more of Federalist Number 10 when Samuel Adams returns, because those anti-federalists, they did. They got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network.